Welcome back to the program. 47 years ago this weekend, on the 100th anniversary of Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, a quarter of a million people, black and white, gathered in Washington for what Martin Luther King called the greatest demonstration of freedom in our nation's history. But the march was, even then, not without its detractors and took place in the context of a fledgling civil rights movement and an escalating war in Vietnam. But in spite of all of that, many believed that such a march could change the course of race relations in America, and in many ways it did. That's our focus this morning, as we're joined by our guest Charles Eichner. He's the author and editor of 8 previous books. He's a lecturer in writing at Yale University. He was the founding executive director of the Rappaport Institute for Greater Boston at Harvard. It is my pleasure to have him here to talk about his book, Nobody Turned Me Around, A People's History of the 1963 March on Washington. Charles Eichner, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
It's great to have you here. How did this march get organized? How did it come about?
Well, the march really originated back in 1941 when a leading black labor leader named A. Philip Randolph decided to have a march down Pennsylvania Avenue to press the Roosevelt administration to force wartime industries to hire blacks. These wartime industries were legally and openly discriminating against blacks. If you were black, don't even bother applying. And so Randolph recruited what was probably 10,000, maybe it would have been as high as 100,000 blacks to march down Pennsylvania Avenue in the middle of a war, World War II, to embarrass the administration into acting on civil rights. President Roosevelt prevailed upon Randolph to call the march off when he signed an executive order banning discrimination in these industries. At the time, it was the most significant advance in civil rights since Reconstruction. But Randolph always wanted to hold a march because he believed, and he was really the first civil rights figure of any stature to believe this and act on it, he believed that if blacks were ever going to overcome their inferiority in society, they had to overcome a kind of psychological sense of inferiority. And to do that, they had to stand up and march and raise their voice out in public. They had to kind of overcome their timidity. And so Randolph was a key figure in the movement, a very much underappreciated figure in the movement, for bringing mass demonstrations into it and for really kind of asserting that blacks had to kind of overcome their own sense of inferiority because before they could expect the nation to grant them equal rights. So fast forward to 1963, just before 63, in December of 62, Randolph meets with his longtime protege named Bayard Rustin, and they talk about what's going to happen on the 100th anniversary of Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. And Rustin knew that Randolph wanted to do this march, and so he started to kind of lobby with him and say, you know, this is your real chance to kind of cement your legacy in civil rights. And so they announced a march for jobs. It was really about economic rights and economic opportunity. And as 1963 moved on, and there were 2,000 demonstrations across the country, most important being, of course, the Birmingham campaign in the spring, it became something much bigger. It became a march for rights and freedom. And President Kennedy introduced civil rights legislation on June 11th and addressed the nation on that day in really uncertain terms about civil rights for the first time. And so it became a massive effort to not just bring blacks up economically, but to bring them into the nation's mainstream politically, socially, and every other way.
One of the fascinating aspects, and it has such contemporary overtones in looking back at this, was the detractors and those people that felt that the march didn't go far enough, that Dr. King and others saw this as a healing event as opposed to a polarizing event, and yet there were many that wanted it to be more polarizing.
Right. Well, there were, you know, this is what I think the true significance of the march was, kind of twofold. King wanted to hold the center together. There was so much violence and there was so much conflict in 1963, and it was coming from both the left and the right, if you want to use those two kind of hackneyed way of looking at things. But on the right, there were segregationists and even white sympathizers who simply thought the civil rights movement was being too aggressive, that pushing for civil rights laws at this time was simply asking too much of the American public. And then there were others who flatly stated that blacks were inferior and they should be segregated forever. So that was one side, one extremist side. And the other extremist side consisted, you know, ranged from students who were putting their lives on the line throughout the South and even into the North, and also the black Muslims led by Malcolm X, who argued that we cannot ask for rights, we have to take them, we have to demand them, and we can't act as if we can persuade whites and segregationists, we have to confront them and beat them down. And King was trying to hold the center, which I think was defined by nonviolence on the one hand and integration. He wanted blacks to become part of the American community. He didn't want blacks to defeat whites. He wanted blacks to join whites. And so the march's real importance, I believe, lay in holding that center and keeping the focus on nonviolence and inclusion and building a better community together rather than one faction defeating another faction.
King also saw it from a political perspective and realized that only if he could create that kind of environment, that kind of safe environment, could he allow the political room for the legislation that Kennedy had proposed to ultimately pass.
Absolutely, and you you just stated it perfectly, because you know, the other significance of the march, in my opinion, was that it was the first time, think about this, it was the first time that all of America had seen the vastness and the diversity of the civil rights movement. You have to understand that in 63, most people were pretty isolated from everyday news. We had, the evening broadcasts were 15 minutes long. The newspapers, most people didn't get a national newspaper or have access to cable TV or internet. Actually, nobody had access to cable TV or internet. But most people got a relatively skimpy daily newspaper that was long on rotary news and school lunches and so forth. And so most Americans simply didn't know what was going on, and they didn't know who these civil rights people were. And they and as a default, they kind of believed what some of the segregationists and people in the media said, which is that they were rabble-rousers trying to unmake the American dream rather than to join the American dream. And so the march was really important because Americans got to see for themselves. This thing was televised live. Americans got to see for themselves who these people were. And when they did, I would say a vast majority of them couldn't deny their humanity and couldn't deny really the modesty of their demands.
It's so fascinating to look at the I Have a Dream speech in this context, because what King was doing is he really threaded the needle between kind of the claim for rights, I mean, as you talk about it with respect to Malcolm X, but did it in a way that expressed a sense of compromise.
Well, and, you know, the first thing he said was that we want to be part of the American dream. And he wasn't willing to compromise on getting rights. He wasn't willing to compromise on being allowed to, you know, for example, being allowed to go into some restaurants but not others, or some schools and not others. He wasn't willing to compromise on some people getting the vote or under very restrained circumstances. He was uncompromising on the moral issues. But he very much wanted to reach out, and not just King, by the way. All too often this becomes just about King. But all the other people on the Mall that day, all the other major leaders of civil rights movements, one of my favorite moments of the day came when Roy Wilkins, who was oftentimes a really kind of prickly character personally, he was full of joy that day, and when he was up at the podium, he spoke directly to segregationists opposing civil rights, and he said, "Give us enough time and we'll emancipate you." And the spirit was very much that we all have something to overcome and we all have something to offer each other. And if that sounds a little corny, so be it. It was the truth, and it was exactly the kind of truth that all of America needed to hear.
It was also kind of the apogee of the nationalization of the civil rights movement in 1963. You talked before about Birmingham and these 2,000 other demonstrations that had taken place. The march was really kind of the culmination of the whole nationalization of this movement in the early 60s.
Oh, very much so. And in 63, the movement made its first major shift northward. The national student movement started to organize in cities like New York and Philadelphia and Chicago and San Francisco and Baltimore, all over the place. And so civil rights was, it's an interesting moment because civil rights was becoming more complex, and this event was probably the last time that the civil rights issue could be stated in such simple terms, which is that you cannot exclude us because of color. And the movement shifted to a much more complex and difficult to maneuver topic as a result of the movement into the North.
Talk about how the Kennedys perceive this march.
Well, the Kennedys at first opposed the march, and they brought Phil Randolph into the White House and some others, and they said, you know, you need to help us tamp down the violence and tamp down the conflict. We don't need people in the streets. And Phil Randolph's response was, Mr. President, people are already in the streets. And when these civil rights leaders told Kennedy directly, sorry, we're going to have it no matter what you want or what you say, at that point Kennedy was very savvy. And he and his administration joined in many ways, not in all ways, but they joined in helping the march happen. Kennedy assigned a number of people in the Justice Department and other federal agencies to help coordinate the march, the parade routes, and the security. And so the Kennedy administration became a real partner. But the key thing was that after more than 2 years of delay and equivocation, the Kennedy administration embraced the movement, and President Kennedy gave really one of the great presidential speeches of all time on June 11th, declaring civil rights to be a moral issue and one not open to negotiation. And so the civil rights legislation was before Congress at that point, and that shifted the march from a protest on all of Washington, including the president and the White House, to a full-court press to get Congress to pass the president's plan. So in the end, Kennedy was an ally of the march, and he hosted the march leaders at the White House after it was over.
It's interesting that the Kennedys, both Kennedy brothers, paid lip service to civil rights during the campaign, but it really seemed that it wasn't until 1963 that they really had a clear picture of what was really transpiring.
Well, they really didn't understand it, and you know, what I was saying about all of America being kind of isolated and not understanding it really applies to the Kennedys also. The Kennedys were children of privilege. We all know that, and that's not a crime to,
right,
to grow up in privileged circumstances. But as a result, they really didn't understand the everyday dignities. And there was one White House meeting where I got transcripts where Bobby Kennedy in particular was kind of questioning, why do they have to push so hard? And at one point he says, why do they need to sit down at a lunch counter? Can't they pee before they come in? And that level of misunderstanding, that level of just not getting it, is kind of astounding. But there was a really kind of significant or extraordinary meeting at Bobby Kennedy's New York apartment organized by the author James Baldwin, and he brought a bunch of the leading lights of black culture to Kennedy's apartment to confront him and really try to help him understand what the race issue was all about. And there was a young man who had been involved in civil rights since he was a teenager. And Bobby Kennedy kind of recited the administration's great gains and great policies on civil rights. And he responded, Mr. Attorney General, you make me want to puke. And it was really jarring. The meeting lasted 3 hours. And Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, was visibly shaken afterwards. Everybody in the room was just ashen and really upset by it. The black leaders because of Kennedy's misunderstanding, and Kennedy because of the lack of appreciation for what the administration had tried to do. But it was shortly after that the Kennedy administration really kind of transformed its attitude. And they, I think from that point on, they got it. And that young man was at the march. And from that point on, I think Bobby Kennedy and Jack Kennedy both were really appreciative of the fundamental crisis that faced the nation.
How did the rest of the country perceive the march in the context of the events leading up to it and the coverage of the march itself?
Well, there was a range of opinion in kind of standard daily newspapers, like the New York Herald Tribune, for example, a fairly conservative mainstream newspaper at the time. And they fretted nonstop about the possibility for violence. Now, the possibility for violence, I think most people understood, was not from the civil rights activists themselves, who had proved their mettle as nonviolent, peaceful protesters. But a lot of peaceful protests turned violent when angry white mobs and even police forces came in and beat them, oftentimes to an inch of their lives. And the American Nazi Party, led at the time by a figure named George Lincoln, Rockwell. George Lincoln Rockwell, thank you. He vowed to bring 10,000 or more Nazis, and he openly talked about wanting to create violence at the march. But the Kennedy administration and the police were all very savvy in dealing with Rockwell, and the march organizers, every single town, every single bus that went to the march, every single train, had very very detailed training on how to respond nonviolently should a thuggish group of whites or racists work their way into the crowd. But as it turns out, Rockwell could only muster a few dozen people, and there was really no threat, there was no threat at all of violence once the march came. But it was an awful summer, 2,000 demonstrations, 50,000 people thrown into jail, some beaten within an inch of their lives, some killed. And so it was not unreasonable to think that things could take a turn for the violent.
And, of course, J. Edgar Hoover stepped up his concerns as a result of this.
Well, it's interesting. Right before the march, J. Edgar Hoover asked one of his top aides, William Sullivan, to do an assessment of the civil rights movement. And he wanted Sullivan to come to the conclusion that communists were using the movement to take over America. And Sullivan investigated, and he came up with a report, and he found no evidence whatsoever that communists were using the march or using the civil rights movement for their own purposes. And he sent that memo to Hoover, and Hoover was angry and essentially replied, "Wrong answer." And he told Sullivan that if he didn't get him the right answers from then on, he would be cut out of any kind of influence. And so, very shortly after the march, Hoover declared King to be the most dangerous Negro in America, which, by the way, the FBI decades before had called Phil Randolph, and began to wiretap him directly before they wiretapped him by wiretapping other people that he was dealing with. And there began the FBI's all-out war against Dr. King.
Talk a little bit about King's speech and how the whole idea of I Have a Dream and the dream imagery came to be.
Well, the dream imagery had been kind of circulating throughout the movement for some time. And people regularly spoke of a kind of new world that they were trying to create. And they used the image of the dream to kind of convey that it might not be here, it might be hard to see, given present circumstances, but if you visualize it, you can make it happen. And King had used the dream motif a couple times, including a speech he gave at a Detroit rally in June of that year. But by the time the march came along, when he was working on his speech the night before the event, his two top aides, Wyatt Walker and Andrew Young, urged him very strongly not to use the dream motif. And Wyatt Walker told me that he considered it to be trite and cliche and overused. But what Wyatt Walker didn't understand is that not all of America had seen it, and that it had this kind of transformative power precisely because it took us out of the kind of difficulty of the present moment. And so King decided to use it the night before. Some people think that he spontaneously pulled it out of the air in the moment, but I have evidence that he was practicing that motif, those lines, the night before the march. And so King was a very savvy speaker, to put it mildly. He was brilliant. And he understood his audiences, and he understood the temper of the times, and he understood what he needed to do to kind of raise people's sights to something higher, and the rest is history.
Tell us about John Lewis's speech.
Well, John Lewis was the 23-year-old leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and he had written a speech that wasn't very good by all accounts. I've never been able to get a hold of it, but it was kind of a preacherly speech. He was a young preacher. And the other members of SNCC, which was the more radical wing of the movement, got a hold of it, and they rewrote it, and then they rewrote it again and again and again. And finally, it was a really kind of fiery kind of group statement on the impatience that young blacks and civil rights activists of all colors were reaching about the kind of trials and tribulations they faced in Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, elsewhere. And so there were a couple of really strong phrases in there. One was the use of the word revolution. Another was an allusion to William Tecumseh Sherman. Lewis said that if civil rights didn't come fast, civil rights activists would march through the South the way Sherman marched through Georgia during the Civil War. Now, anybody knows that mentioning General Sherman is fighting words in the South. He was the one who burned all those cities and towns on his way to the sea from Atlanta. And so the Catholic Archbishop for Washington, who was a major kind of establishment figure in the movement, said that he would withdraw and pull all of the Catholics with him unless Lewis changed the speech. And there was a lot of back and forth the night before the speech and into the next day, and they did change it. In my opinion, it was every bit as strong or maybe even stronger, but by removing a couple specific offending words, they managed to keep the Catholics on board. And they also, I believe, that this moment contributed in very important ways to the burgeoning free speech movement, which began at University of California, Berkeley, the next year.
We talked earlier about Malcolm X and his opposition to the march, and yet you write that he secretly vowed to help the march, even though publicly he was opposed to it.
Well, this is the thing about Malcolm. He considered himself a brother above all else, and again, that might sound corny, but he had a habit of speaking oftentimes in really vicious, mean-spirited terms against not only whites and white liberals, but against civil rights leaders. He had a habit of being really harsh in public and then helping out in private. One of my favorite moments of this whole moment in history was when Floyd McKissick, who was representing the Congress of Racial Equality at the march, he saw Malcolm at the Statler Hilton Hotel in the lobby, and he went up and embraced him. And the young people who were with McKissick said, "What in the world are you embracing him for? Have you heard what he said? What he's saying about us?" And he's calling it the farce on Washington, and he's mocking us. And McKissick said, "You know what? I was in danger of losing my life and having my house burned down by Klansmen, and Malcolm sent his people to protect me. And so he's my brother, and I am going to embrace him when I see him." And, you know, the civil rights movement is a lot more complicated, and the figures are a lot more complicated than we sometimes remember. And even when we think of complications, for example, the tensions between King and Whitney Young and Roy Wilkins and Malcolm X, even when we think of the tensions, we still kind of simplify those as well. And I think that, you know, Malcolm had not kind of made his final evolution. He had not made his final change in political agenda, but he was first and foremost a brother. And if he differed on policy, he still considered himself a brother to the civil rights movement.
Is it fair to say that the march really was the apex of the civil rights movement in the 60s?
Well, I think it is in the following sense. I mean, you could point to so many great moments and call them the apex. You could point to the Freedom Rides. You could point to the Selma March. You could point to the Birmingham campaign. You could point to the Montgomery campaign. So there's lots of high points. But in the following sense, I think the march is the apex, and that is that it brought all America into the movement. It changed America's collective understanding of what civil rights were all about. And the very next year, when the major civil rights legislation passed, it kind of brought about a new phase to the movement where marches and protests and sit-ins and these other forms of direct action were no longer quite as central to the cause. And so in that sense, it was maybe not a culmination or a peak, but it was kind of one of the final moves before the major legislation passed.
It also seems that it was the last kind of pure moment of the civil rights agenda before Vietnam would enter into the equation.
I think that's exactly right. And one of the things I find ironic is on that very day that the marchers were massing on the mall, President Kennedy was meeting with his aides in the White House to discuss whether or not to assassinate the president of South Vietnam. And one of the reasons there was such a crisis in South Vietnam, I mean one of about 100, was that the South Vietnamese president, Diem, was horribly repressing the activists in South Vietnam who drew their inspiration from King. So in one of the cruel ironies of history, the South Vietnamese regime became more repressive because of the influence of King on the opposition. That's not to say King's influence was anything less than benign, but Diem didn't know how to deal with it, and so he became less and less a legitimate figure, which drew the U.S. deeper and deeper into that conflict.
What were the concerns that day with respect to security?
Well, the big concern, as we discussed before, was that some kind of white mob would wedge itself into the march and start throwing punches and perhaps even worse. And in fact, there were some attacks on some of the marchers on the buses and trains coming into Washington. And people just didn't know what would happen. And so the military was on high alert. And there was a young lawyer in the Justice Department who sat in the war room with a bunch of four-star generals prepared to issue military instructions should they be needed. But anybody who really understood the movement, and Bayard Breston made this in a meeting with police from Washington, D.C., anybody who understood the movement really knew that it was nonviolent to the core and that he, as organizer, and others were really working hard to teach whoever went to the march how to respond should there be any kind of attack, whether it's just a verbal attack or a punch thrown or a phalanx of white thugs moving into the march. And so on one level, the fear of violence, it was probably good to be aware of that threat and to be prepared for it. On another level, it was kind of silly because the civil rights movement was not the source of any of this violence in the first place.
Charles Eichner, the book is Nobody Turned Me Around, A People's History of the 1963 March on Washington. It's just out from Beacon Press. Charles, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.